I have a dream.
One small step.
How many we say
the wall must go.
Diner, Princess of Wales.
Into the World Trade Center.
Winner is Sydney.
This week in history.
Well, for this week in history on Nightlife, we're going back to the 24th of January 1972, when a fearful and dishevelled man was discovered by two local shrimp fishermen in the jungles of Guam, an island in Micronesia. His name was Shoichi Yokokoi. He was a Japanese imperial soldier who'd been hiding on the island since 1944, when the US Army had stormed Guam as part of a huge offensive against the Japanese forces during World War II. What had he been doing for 28 years? Did he know the war had ended? And what happened to him when he finally returned to Japan? To answer some of these questions is author Christine Kohler. She joins us from Texas in the US, and she's been so inspired and intrigued by this story. She's written a novel inspired by Shoichi, which is called No Surrender Soldier. Thanks so much for your time, Christine. Great to have you on the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Now, what first attracted you to this story? You were on Guam when you first heard about it.
It would have been more than a decade after Yokoi had been captured and taken off of Guam. And I worked as a foreign correspondent and political reporter for the Pacific Daily News, owned by Gannett. So my territory was the West Pacific, only most of it was underwater. But while I was on Guam, obviously my children, they went to school on the southern part of the island near Talofofo. And so I heard the story of Yokoi. And of course, it was just fascinating, but it wasn't until, about a decade later, I was working, maybe longer than that, but anyways, I was working as an editor for the San Antonio Express News in Texas, and I just could not get him out of my mind. I had been writing books for quite a while, and I just started getting research, and at that time, the internet in a home situation was new. And so it was difficult to get the materials. But because I had lived on Guam, I was very fortunate in that the head of the Micronesian Center in Guam, and also at the University of Guam, and also the publisher of Gannett out at the Pacific Daily News, they were able to get all of the materials that I need that were the initial news reports, the first sources, the eyewitness accounts. And they sent me all of these papers. I also got some books from Japan that were translated into English, like all of the journalist collections from Japan, the Japanese journalist, and different accounts in an autobiography. And I just read everything on it. And I thought in the back of my head that I was going to write a nonfiction book, because like I said, I have other nonfiction books published.
Yeah.
And then one morning I just woke up and I thought, no, I am going to write a novel, and it's going to be from the viewpoint of a 15-year-old Chamorro boy. That's the indigenous people there. And it's going to take place during the Vietnam era, at the point that they brought Shoichi Yokoi out. And the thing is that it's going to be about this young boy, this teen boy, who finds out an atrocity happened in particular to his mother and his family. And the theme is actually how war affects families for generations.
Yes, and lives on in so many different ways and different
right.
forms. Yeah, but
right.
you also tell the perspective of this Japanese soldier living underground for many years,
yes,
in
I
these
do.
Tunnels. Yeah, and he's eating,
yes, I do.
Eating rats. And so how, before we go into his life, I mean, how difficult was it to distinguish between fact and fiction in what had been written about him over the years? Because, you know, there's been all these sort of wild stories about him.
Mm. Well, the thing is that even in preparing for this program, it's interesting how that it seems like after the first accounts, then everything kept changing every time people wrote about it. And then it was like that game that children play, telephone. And then whatever was the myth became the story more than the original story.
Yeah.
And that was interesting. But originally, it's in two points of view. And so you're right. Every other chapter is from the viewpoint of this older soldier, this 58-year-old soldier who's underground. And at first, I kept it very strictly to Yokoi's life. I tried to get into his psyche. I tried to look at what Aristotle would call the pathos and the ethos of the character. And I stuck very much to that. And then it was more at the time of the capture that I couldn't get the story to bend and in a story arc. And that was where I had to deviate and change.
Okay. Well, let's go back a bit to about him. Where was he born and when did he serve in the Japanese Imperial Army?
Okay. Yokoi, he was born in March 31st, 1915. What happened was his mother, she wanted very much to have a child. So she went to the mountain and she prayed to the mountain and she had this child. And then what's really sad is when he was three, the father divorced her. And so then she left completely. And so actually his father reared Yokoi, Shoichi. And then when he was 12, his mother did remarry, but he stayed with his father. And his father was a tailor and he trained him to be a tailor. And then in about 38, he got his, I guess we would call them like conscription papers. And he was supposed to be for temporary duty. But then in August 1941, Yokoi was sent with an infantry to Manchuria, China. Later, he went to Korea. And then it was not until February 1943 that Yokoi was sent to Guam with an infantry division to the supply unit in Talofofo.
Okay, so he wasn't on Guam for that long. What was the military action that led to the day that he was separated from his platoon? This is when the Americans took the island back, pretty much.
Right. Guam, of course, had been a U.S. possession of the United States prior to Japan capturing it and occupying it. And when Japan had occupied, they were very brutal with the people. Anyway, so July 21st, 1944, through August 10th, 1944, the U.S. Marines came back and they stormed Guam. They defeated the Japanese army. They liberated the Guamanian people. And at that time, like the Japanese soldiers, they would commit harakiri. They would commit suicide if they didn't have their sword or gun or bayonet to do it in the samurai style. Then they would even put their grenades like under their helmets and blow their heads off. And it was just very horrible. But they were taught to do this because in Code 2, Article Section 8 of the Code of Conduct of Battle from January 8, 1941, the emperor had said, "No one shall remain alive to incur the shame of becoming a prisoner of war." Well, there were some soldiers like Yokoi who were sort of caught in this situation where they just couldn't bring themselves to commit suicide, and yet they couldn't surrender. It was like the most shameful thing to surrender. I think they might have also been afraid because they were told that the U.S. would treat them horribly if they were captured. And so because of that, he went and just ran and hid in the jungle.
And he wasn't alone, was he? There were some other men who did the same, some fellow soldiers.
Right. There were other soldiers that went different places. But in particular, there were two soldiers, Shichi and Nakahata. And they were lesser rank than Yokoi. Yokoi at this time was a lance corporal. And they went with him. And the three of them stayed together. But then once they were in the jungle, at first they stayed in a cave. But then once they were in the jungle and some time had passed, then Yokoi always lived separate from them, even though they lived maybe within yards or 15 minutes at the most from each other.
And was that because of rank? He was above them, so he didn't want to live with them?
I never could figure that out. That was one of the things that I just tried to figure out for the story.
Yeah.
But I really, really could not figure out why. Maybe they didn't get along. I just really don't know.
Okay. We're talking to Christine Kohler on Nightlife, who's an author inspired by the story of Yokoi Shoichi, who was a Japanese soldier who hid on Guam for 28 years. It was on 1972 when he was found. So what kind of life did he lead? He, as you said, he lived in a cave for some time, but then he lived in an elaborate tunnel system that he built for many years.
Yes, that was the part that was the most fascinating. And first of all, I want to back up just 1 minute. A lot of the accounts say that he did not know that the war was over. And I found that not to be true at all. Again, I used the accounts from the very beginning and then his own words. And he said that when they first, when Japan first surrendered, when they first went in, that someone went around with bullhorns on the U.S., on Guam, and announced that Japan had lost the war and that all the stragglers, that's what they called them, stragglers, were supposed to report to Agano, which was the capital city. And at that time, Yokoi still would not surrender and his two comrades. And he just believed that Japan was going to recapture the island. So he stayed in.
Right. But so then, he knew that they'd surrendered, but he thought they'd go back on their surrendering, that the war would come back?
Yes, he was hoping that Japan would come back and recapture it. Mm-hmm. But then 1 year later, then what the U.S. Military did was they took a plane and they dropped leaflets all over the jungle. They were trying to get the stragglers to come out. And the thing is that when the leaflets, actually, I saw one of these leaflets, and it actually showed General McNamara and the emperor on a ship off Japan, and they were signing a treaty for the surrender. And so at that point, then it had this paragraph, and I put it in my book that he read. And so he did know it was over for sure.
He'd seen that pamphlet. Okay.
Yeah. Right. And so within a year's time, he had two different notices that the war was over. But then they lived, like you said, in the jungle, first in caves, and then they made these bamboo huts. Well, what happened was that they called them the Camacho homes after Mayor Camacho or Governor Camacho, I'm sorry, on Guam. And they were encroaching in the Guamanians call it the boonies, but it's actually a jungle. It was encroaching on the jungle and encroaching in the area where they were living. And they were concerned about getting found out. And so at that point, Yokoi built an underground cave. And this was unbelievable. If you got a World War II cannon shell and part of it was broken, it would be about the size of a garden spade. And he took part of that cannon shell that he got from a U.S. dump and he dug out a hole and then put a shaft down it and put a bamboo ladder down it. And he dug it 8 feet, which would be 2.5 meters deep. And then he dug it 10 feet, which is 3 meters long and only about, 3 or 4 feet tall, about 1 meter tall. And he couldn't even stand up in it. He could sit in it and crawl in it. On both ends were these compartments. And the one end toward the Talofofo River, first, let me back up. Talofofo is gorgeous and it very tropical. And it has a river going through it. And it also has a waterfall. It's just a beautiful area. But he made this tunnel going out from his one compartment to the Talofofo ring as a drainage system for his latrine in there. And then the other end, he carved out, put shelves, and made a way to make a stove, a cooking area. And then he did a shaft up through the bamboo grove above him. And so then if he would catch meat, like one time he caught a wild boar and he got really sick and he swore he'd never eat pig again. But a couple times he caught a deer because he even made his own nets and everything. And then he would shove them up in that shaft and he would smoke them just like you're going to make meat on the, we call it a grill. I think you call it the Barbie.
Yeah, like a barbecue. Right.
Right.
Barbecue. I mean, he had incredible ingenuity. So he would eat what? Deer, local animals, rats, and forage for coconuts and fruit.
Now the coconuts, he did everything with them. When I do talks, I show a coconut and because a lot of people, you know what they look like there. But anyways, he didn't just use the threads and husk from the outside, but he also made containers from them. He used the meat and the milk for himself and to cook with, but he also used that meat, the coconut meat, to catch shrimp. And he would catch shrimp in the Talofofo River, and he made his own shrimp traps. He found a metal cage in the dump is what he used to catch the rats with. There's these big snails. They call them African snails, I think. And he would get those and eat them. Of course, because it's so tropical in season, he would eat breadfruit, mangoes, papaya.
Unbelievable. And he made his own clothes from plants.
And he was so proud of his clothes because he was a tailor. Mm. And he had needles. I don't know if he took those needles in with him in the jungle in like his own backpack, his knapsack. But he had needles and they were in this little case about the size of a bullet shell. And the thing is that he took the hibiscus plant. The Guamanians call them pego. And you know how on the outside of the bark that it's got those kind of stringy things and you can shred it? And he shredded those and he made the threads and the fibers and wove the fabric. And then he made these clothes. And in the pants, he was so proud. He had belt loops and he had button down fly and he put buttons on his shirt and pockets. And it would have the texture of about hemp if you had a hemp cloth.
Oh, hemp's and, nice. Yeah.
He made buttons from flashlight, the plastic part on the flashlights that he got from a dump. Incredible. It was just, he was very proud of his clothing.
He was amazingly resourceful. We're talking about the Japanese soldier who hid for 28 years on Guam. So how many of those years were underground and how many alone? Because the other two who he lived near died, didn't they?
Yes. He lived 13 years above ground in the caves and in the bamboo hut. And then he lived 15 years underground in this place I just described under the ground, this cave underground. And of that, the last 8 years were totally alone. And as far as the two men, Shichi and Nakahata, who died, they lived at that time about 15 minutes from him. And he kept saying that he thought they were poisoned to death. And he was very upset when they found him because of these ghosts that kept visiting him in his cave and also in the hospital. And so he insisted that the U.S. authorities get the bones. He told them exactly where they were. And they went and the authorities went and got the bones. And sure enough, they were all mingled together in exactly where he told them. And so at the Guam Memorial Hospital, they did these medical tests on the bones. And they determined that these two men had been poisoned, and they think that they had eaten possibly toads or these one nuts that are poisonous.
Oh, okay. And so they poisoned themselves accidentally. It's not that they were poisoned by the local population.
Right. Mm-hmm. And that was one of the things that, you know, how I told you through the years, it was kind of like playing that child's game telephone and everything would change.
Yeah.
I read so many reports later that said that they possibly committed suicide, but that was not what they found with the medical tests in the beginning, that it was probably an accidental poisoning.
Okay. All right. So you said that he hid and he knew the war was over. So, but we don't sort of know his state of mind completely about why he just didn't eventually come out. I mean, was it shame that he had run away and not committed harakiri? What did he say when he eventually did go back to Japan? And we'll talk about how he was found in just a moment. But I want to get back to his psyche as much as you can put yourself in his place, which you did for your book.
Right. And in the research that I found, that was the conclusion I came to, is that he did have a very deep shame just for himself. He didn't want to bring shame on his family. And the thing that really, I think, just summed it up was when he got off of the plane in Japan, then that was what he did, was that he bowed and he said, "I am ashamed, yet I live. I have come home."
So when he was captured, he went willingly. Basically, he wasn't captured. He was discovered by some locals on Guam. He went quite willingly with them.
Yes. They offered him food and he went with them willingly, yes.
What kind of state was he in when he was found after 28 years of living in a jungle, 15 of them underground.
This is where, if people get a chance to see my website, I have pictures on there. And he was quite scraggly, I guess. Mm. He was hunched over. They think he might have a genital type thing that made him have a curved spine, a curvature of the spine. But the thing is if you think about him being down in that tunnel all the time, oh my goodness, and he couldn't straighten up.
Yeah,
you know, it's hard to tell whether it was hereditary or whether it was, you know, from the way he lived.
Not being able to stand up for 15 years properly, although he would go out at night and hunt and sleep in the day, so he would stand up when he was outside.
The doctors examined him at the Guam Memorial Hospital, and they found that he was in relatively good health. He had a vitamin B deficiency and swollen feet. What I found was interesting is that they didn't treat him for the vitamin B deficiency because they were concerned about the Japanese diplomats and everything and what they wanted to do. And they kept insisting that they were going to examine him and treat him for what anything at the Japanese hospitals. And so because of that, even though they knew he had a vitamin B deficiency, they put him on the plane as is, so to speak, so that after 10 days, so that the Japanese doctors could examine him as he came out of the jungle.
You're on Nightlife. Sarah McDonald's my name, and we're going back in history to someone who I suppose jumped history because he spent 28 years out of contact with the rest of the world, Shaichi Yokokoi. It was in 1972 he came out of the jungles of Guam. So he went back to Japan, and I mean, he had left Japan in 1941. He goes back in 72. He's missed all these years and so much has changed. He then became a bit of a media darling. How did he cope settling back into normal life?
Well, you're right. He was very confused when they brought him out as far as everything that he had missed, because when he was still on Guam, for instance, they asked him tons of questions. I mean, the reporters did, first American reporters and then Japanese reporters who flew in. And there were so many things, like he was confused in the very beginning because the Japanese consul was named James and he couldn't understand why a Japanese man would have a Christian name. He couldn't understand why there were Japanese businessmen on Guam. He couldn't understand why they were dressed in Western clothing. I mean, it was just everything. He didn't know what a TV was. They tried to explain Hiroshima and Nagasaki. They tried to explain the atomic bomb. He just couldn't even wrap his head around any of that. And then he wanted to know if it was Japan's bomb and that what had happened. It was just very confusing. But once he got back, he actually must have adapted pretty well, because he married 9 months later, a 44-year-old woman. They honeymooned on Guam. He visited Guam like 10 to 12 times. He really missed it and liked it. Of course, I lived in both Japan and Guam, and honestly, I keep thinking, you know, he went back in February. It would have been a horribly cold in Japan at that time.
Yes, you know? Freezing.
And after living the tropics for so long, it's really hard to go back to a winter climate like that in the middle of winter. I mean, I'm speaking from experience here.
Yeah.
But anyways, so
adding to the culture shock, the time shock, the, you know, jumped out of history for a while shock, then there's the weather shock.
Yes.
But I imagine he wanted I can understand why he got married. He'd spent a lot of time alone, and as you said, haunted by ghosts. He must have wanted some company. But he actually ended up running for parliament and working and having a reasonably normal life.
He did. It was just 2 years after he came out of the jungle. I was actually surprised it was so fast. And he ran for, they call it the House of Counselors, but you're right, it would have been similar to the parliament. He lost and he was upset. He said it costs money to run for public office and he's never doing it again. And he never did. But he was a big believer in economy of living. He just couldn't believe how much people spent on everything, how much money they spent on everything. And so he tended a garden. He did a big garden in his yard, and he bragged about him and his wife being self-sustaining from the vegetables in their garden. And then when he wrote his autobiography and also did a documentary, he focused on life after returning to Japan, but he also espoused his doctrine of the economy of living, he called it.
So just a simplicity of life that he had discovered while living so simply in the jungle.
Well, when he was in the jungle, I called it deprivation. Mm. And so I'm not sure he lived a life of deprivation in Japan, but in the jungle, I mean, I don't know that we can begin to fully understand. I mean, there's a lot of survivalist shows today where they, you know, it's almost like a game. But I mean, this was really deprivation, how he lived in the jungle.
Unbelievable. I mean, you said he met visited ghosts. I would imagine after 28 years on your own, 15 of it underground, you'd be pretty, I'd be crazy. I would have gone mad. Was he sane?
The one reason why that they kept him for 10 days in the hospital in Guam before they let him go back to Japan is they were concerned about his mental state, and it was because of the ghost, because of him telling him about the ghost visiting. But otherwise, they thought he was. And then the only time it was only brought up again, his mental state in Japan, was that he, when he was in Japan, he confessed to being one of the, him and his comrades murdering two young men who were on Guam. It was a young man, Francisco Duenas, and he was 15, and also Jesus Pablo, 26. They were out shrimp trapping or doing something in the jungle. And they had, it was quite brutal. They cut up their hands and feet, and they shot him, and they decapitated him.
Oh, and him and the then other when, soldiers, yeah.
Mm-hmm, when Yokoi admitted to this on Japan, then right away the Japanese government said, no, he was mentally confused. So those were the only two times that his mental state was raised in any of the research I did.
Right. And the people who found him, the shrimp fishermen who found him, actually one of them was related to one of those who he murdered.
Mm. Yes, Jesus Duenas was the younger brother of the man, Francisco, who had been murdered as a teen, and Manuel de Gracia. And the thing is that was why the Guam legislature had given them commendation, because they said that they acted in a Christian way, that they were very kind to Yokoi when they could have been very vengeful under the circumstances once they realized who he was.
Absolutely. Yeah, they broke that cycle of violence and hatred. So you have written a novel, as we said, No Surrender Soldier, which is based on his story and inspired by his story. You changed it to being the local Guam boy's perspective as the main story, though. It's an amazing story, and just what a powerful experience for you to get into that headspace. He's died now, hasn't he? Well, tell us about the end of his life.
Yes. He died September 22nd, 1977, at age 82. He, like I said, he did have this one book out when I was doing some research just within the last couple of weeks, kind of brushing up on stuff. I found out that his wife's nephew had a book come out in 2009, but read that one because I did my research before that. So other than that, there really hasn't been much done or anything done about his life that I know of since he died.
Well, thank you so much for talking to us tonight about his very strange and fascinating life. I mean, he was definitely resourceful and powerful to imagine living for 28 years so isolated. It's an incredible story.
Well, I thank you for having me.
Thanks so much, Christine. Great to chat.
You too.
Christine Cole has been my guest. No Surrender Soldier is her novel, and she's an author who's done a lot of extensive research about this story.
Nightlife with Sarah McDonald on ABC Radio.